AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream.
Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work. In traffic, so slow.
Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome. You are now listening to The Professional Homegirl.
Homegirls, it's the Kid Ebony from the PhD podcast, the only place where you would hear interviews from Black women anonymously on stories that would enlighten and expand on taboo topics. Now, if you hear someone that sounds familiar, mind the business that pays you, child. If you like the PhD podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Please, 5-star reviews only. Hold me down, don't hold me up. Merch is now available on the site as well as my book list, so please make sure you visit the link in the show notes below. You can connect with the Kid on Instagram at The Professional Homegirl and at the PhD Podcast. If you are on Twitter, please follow me at the PhD Podcast. Now, if you are all caught up with episodes, listen to the bonus episodes by supporting the PhD Podcast Patreon account. To support, please visit www.patreon.com/the PhD Podcast. Now, please keep in mind that all of my guests are anonymous, so let's begin this week's episode.
So I am super excited about this week's episode because if y'all are not inspired by this conversation, I don't know what to tell y'all. Our guest is a trauma survivor and an internationally recognized trauma-informed care expert. Along with being an author and an award-winning film producer, our guest travels all over the world, providing tools and resources on combating trauma, addiction, incarceration, homelessness, substance abuse, and mental health. She is out here doing the Lord's work, y'all. So to my guest, how are you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Of course. Y'all, this is another guest that I've been working on for over a year, and she finally agreed. Yes, I emailed you August 8, 2021.
Something like that. Okay. So let me tell you what happened. So, hey, guys. So what happens is, when people contact me, they usually do it through DM or messaging. Mm-hmm. So I actually have to go look for them. You know what I mean? Because for some, I have to go to like the request. I have to go to request section. Mm-hmm. I got to go to all the different sections. And so sometimes, because people say, I DM'd you. And I'm like, I didn't get it because I only get the ones that's actually friends.
Right.
So I have to look for the ones that's not so, but I'm sorry.
No, you don't have to apologize. I know you're busy.
I got people that told me they contact me in 2008. I said, 2008? I was 4 years out of prison. How 2008? I don't want no Facebook or nothing.
Well, you know they lying.
I know. you looking for some money, honey? Did I owe you something?
Right. Like, I know you want me, but don't lie now, because I wasn't even around 2008.
I was just 4 years old, and I was doing some things, but not like on this level. Why are you walking up to me? I needed to be talking to you.
Right. We're gonna have fun. I love talking to, I consider you my OG, so I would try my best to make sure I refrain from using certain language, because I want to be respectful. Unless you go there.
Oh, no, you fine. Please.
Okay.
I'm tripping about that.
Okay. Can you explain what trauma is and how it can show up in one's life?
Absolutely. So trauma is, there's different levels, different types of trauma that people talk about. What I talk about most importantly is the interpersonal experience of trauma. That is when you personally yourself experience trauma, rather it's like domestic violence, sexual abuse, child abuse, you know, when you personally experiencing a trauma, physical abuse, verbally abuse, and things like that. And then there's the witnessing of trauma, which is all, you know, witnessing somebody else, like say, like you watch your mother being beaten by your father, the domestic violence in the house. Or even community violence. My new film, I just premiered a new film called Walking Through Bullets, and it's a gang-related film. Talk about how the what happened to the boys that had experienced community violence and the men they became because of that. And so disaster, right? I mean, come on now, COVID was the pandemic that we experienced is trauma. So anything that causes you to be fearful, feeling helpless, you know what I mean? And when things happen to you that is unusual, that it caused harm to you mentally, physically, psychologically, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you asked me that, because a lot of people don't ask me that, you know, and I think it's important that we talk about what we mean by trauma, because growing up, when somebody talked about trauma, I thought it was when somebody got hit by a car.
Right.
Or when somebody came back from war, right?
Right.
So, but no, we're talking about the common traumas now that's happening in everyday life. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad I talk to experts all over the world, and no one really go in with that question, and they should, because a lot of times the listeners don't even understand what we mean by trauma. And mm-hmm. we talk about trauma informed, how to heal from trauma, what trauma, because they are so used to these things happening, they're almost like the norm.
Right. One of the reasons why I really like your story is because I went through a lot of trauma when I was growing up, and it showed up in my adulthood. And I didn't have the language for it until my grandmother passed away and I started going to therapy. And if I'm not mistaken, because I just had my therapy session with her today, I think she is a trauma specialist. Okay. And she explained to me what trauma was. And I'm like, oh, that's what I've been experiencing all these years.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I'm so glad that you have someone, a trauma therapist, because we don't have a lot of them. You know, and so we have our traditional therapist that's, come on now.
Right.
He's sitting there telling you a whole hour of something, and then you swipe in my card for $150.
Right.
We're really talking about, because trauma, anytime you talk to a trauma therapist, one, this is how you know they're really a trauma therapist. They follow your lead. You're not following theirs.
Mm-hmm.
They're letting you lead it. Let you know, they're masking your emotions and letting you leading it, where they're not, you know, leading the questions, and they kind of letting you talk as you want to talk and about what you want to talk, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. then they kind of help shape it for you and bring it full circle for you.
Why do you think we don't have a lot of trauma therapists? Or is it too much?
A lot of people are not trained in it. A lot of people, so many people are trained the traditional way of providing services.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2007, when SAMHSA thought about funding, when they started understanding the impact of trauma in our public health systems, right? 2008, they funded the National Center for Trauma-Informed Care. They brought me in as their team leader. The National Center for Trauma-Informed Care was not established until 2008.
Wow.
I was their team leader. I led their team for 5 years. My job was to take a team around the country to inform our public health systems about the impact of trauma on the individual and why we need to have different methods of how we treat them.
Right. And
So that was just in 2008. That's why.
Yeah, that was yesterday.
I ran the corner. You know, so.
Can trauma be mistaken for mental disorders?
I think that the mental health providers don't know how to distinguish it because they don't understand the impact of trauma. So let me give you an example. For many years, they were diagnosing me with bipolar. Mm-hmm. Told me I had borderline this, borderline that. I didn't. What I had was exhibiting symptoms of my trauma. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, responding to my trauma in a way that helped me, which to them was symptoms of a mental health illness.
Right.
Because all they do is read the book. They don't understand people. Mm-hmm. And so
Black people.
Oh yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think that they, you know, we're beginning to understand that a lot of people that they thought was mentally ill was really not mentally ill. They just had untreated trauma.
Right.
So yeah, so there is a difference. And, you know, however, trauma can cause mental health issues, mm-hmm. of course, depression and all of that. So that's why we train people on providing trauma-informed care so we can prevent people from that escalation or the downward spiral, you know?
Right.
Spiral downward. Mm-hmm.
Do you think eventually there will be more treatment for trauma?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It have to be because all the money that's pushed down now from mental, so SAMHSA is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. That is the top government agency that pushed money down into mental health and substance abuse facilities. And DOJ pushed money down into correction. DOJ is understanding the impact of trauma. SAMHSA is all way ahead of the game now.
Right.
So anytime you obtain and maintain funding now, you're going to have to be able to provide some kind of trauma treatment, have some kind of trauma services.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know what? You made a good point because now I'm starting to think about all the people that are on medication that didn't even need it. They just needed some type of treatment. Right.
They just need to be able to. So the only difference between me now and Ebony, right?
Ebony.
Oh, I like that. Ebony. We always got to switch it up. Sometimes we're done.
Okay. That put a little salt on it. Yeah.
You know? And so, they were giving me Thorazine, Ativan, and lithium at the same time. Mm-hmm. I remember crawling down I was in the detention center. I was so heavily medicated where I couldn't walk. Mm-hmm. And so the only difference between me now and me 18 years ago, my trauma I'm still triggered. I still remember my trauma. I just have learned how to develop healthier tools to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So what's happening is you got a whole bunch of people with trauma unidentified. First, it hasn't been identified, addressed, or treated. Mm-hmm. And so if it hasn't been identified, then they don't understand their triggers. If they don't understand their triggers, they don't understand that they need to do something, a healthier way to deal with it. My unhealthy way to dealing with my trauma was crack cocaine, alcohol, all the things that went along with that, right?
Right.
So my trauma hasn't gone away. I haven't forgotten anything that happened to me. I haven't gotten the rapes. I've been beaten, raped so many times I can't even count. I stopped counting them. And so what the difference is now is I have healthier tools now. I had to be able to identify my trauma first, address it, and then the treatment, part of treatment was obtaining some tools to help me to deal with it, to stay self-regulated. And so that's what it is. People are not understanding it, people are not addressing it, nor are they treating it. And if they did, a lot of them would not need a medication.
Right. Before we get into your story, I just want to let people know that y'all, she looks good. That skin is glowing.
I own my own skincare line, so if my skin didn't glow, something would be wrong.
Her teeth on point. Like, she looks good, y'all. Like, I just want to throw that out there. She just came back.
You said that I have no makeup. I just got the shower from the gym. I look awful.
She didn't want to show me her face. I'm like, come on now, show me your face. Like, she looks good. So you do not look like what you've been through. Because I read your book last night, and I was just like, my God, like, yeah. You've been through a lot, which we'll get to later, but it was a lot.
Yeah.
Do you think people are desensitized from trauma because most of us have been through it and survived?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's like now with, like, school shootings, right?
Yeah.
School shootings happening, and we see it in the news, and go, oh my God, that's awful. And then that's it.
Right.
That's it. You know, and there's so many school shootings happening a day where it don't even make the national news anymore.
Right.
Because, so it's like that. Yeah. Like COVID now. Once upon a time, you heard somebody get COVID, you go,
right.
And now, if somebody get COVID, you was like, all right, let me know when your isolation period is over.
Right. No, people don't care. And I was telling my best friend this. I'm like, yo, we live in a very effed up society because nobody care about anything no more. It's like somebody got shot. Well, people get shot every day. It's just like, no.
It's we're living in some very dark times, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that we can just go on with our lives, like, we watch New York City have trucks, freezers outside to put all the dead bodies in that was dying from, and it was us. It was us, yeah. Right? And for us to watch that and still at the end of the day, not trying to encourage each other to live healthier lives. So I have a new TV show that I'm producing called Our Journeys, right?
Okay.
You should contact me if you want to be on it.
Contact. Yes.
So it's about our journeys. It's about wellness after trauma, right? Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to bring how important it is to that we all connected. Our body, our mind, our spirit, it's all connected. Mm-hmm. And one feed off the other. So if we are taking care of stuff the best way we can, and we're thinking the best way we can, and all of that is connected, and it's going to do well for us. It's, I watch, oh my goodness, the shootings, everything was happening in 2020. Just, I couldn't breathe. I was George Floyd, Arbor. I mean, it's like
Breonna Taylor.
Right.
It was a lot.
In COVID.
I'm not going to lie. I was definitely in therapy a lot because, I live on myself. Our stories are somewhat similar, especially when it comes to our relationship with our parents and our families. And so just being on my own, it was a lot. It was very intense and I was scared.
Look, at one point I cried. And I'm like, how do people that aren't mentally stable, right? Mm-hmm. Or have yet to find ways to deal with their trauma, how are they getting through these times?
Yeah.
If you already have trauma in your life that you're dealing with, right? Mm-hmm. And then you look at how in the households of the kids that were being abused, how that was skyrocketing because kids weren't going to school now. They couldn't get away from the abusive parents,
yeah,
or the stepfather that was sexually abusing. I mean, it was like,
yeah, it was a lot.
That was a lot. We have a lot to be grateful for that we survived it, right?
Yeah. I think even for me, what was very traumatizing was just seeing Black people being killed nonstop. Oh,
that right there. I went downtown to march.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got downtown, I went downtown Annapolis, Maryland. So in Annapolis, Maryland, if you've ever been to Annapolis, Maryland is surrounded by the Chesapeake Bay. Downtown is beautiful. Mm-hmm. However, right there where they were marching, right there is where Kunta Kinte got off the ship.
Mm.
You see, right there is Alex Haley Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
Here we were marching right there in the circle.
Right.
And you know the saddest part about it all? The most assertive, let's say that, people that was out there didn't look like us.
Of course.
The ones that was holding the sign, the ones that was pissed off,
mm-hmm.
didn't look like us.
I said, you know it's real when the white people are mad.
Oh, they were hot. They were, no justice, no peace, no justice. No justice, no peace. They were hot.
I said, white people don't even want to be white no more, child.
They were hot. They were like this with the officers.
They were bold too.
They were tearing down monuments.
They were looting. I said, yo, they were
climbing up monuments. They were tearing down monuments.
I went to one march and I had to just sit back and watch them because they was out of control.
I know, that's what I'm saying. So I seen them and I was like,
I know. They are pissed.
They were gonna tear it up.
Oh my God.
They were gonna tear it up. But that, I cried. And you know, at the time I was going to a very Southern Baptist church because the area that I lived in was all white area. So I went down to, I used to go to a Southern Baptist church with one or two only regularly attending Black families. And not one person at church, after I expressed my distress, reached out to me. And it was tough. Yeah.
Do you think one day churches will no longer be relevant?
I think churches are, if they are relevant now, they are who they serving.
Right.
My thing is, who you serving? If you still preaching to, you got Mama Betty in the front, she 80 years old. She right. been six pastors. She'd heard a message. She had six pastors tell her the same thing over 80 years.
Mm-hmm.
It is a time to get from behind the pulpit and get in the streets.
Yeah.
First of all, Jesus ain't preached to the same people over and over again. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And we supposed to, the fact, you know what gets me? Mega churches.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I don't get why somebody want a pastor that they can't get to when they need them.
Mm.
You got his security, their security, the security's got security. And then you got all the greats, I guess, in the front. I don't know. I guess they're the ones that go above the 10%. I don't know. You know? And so it is, I need a church when I leave, my pastor standing right there to talk mm-hmm. to everybody leaving out the door. I never understood that mega church, why people want to go to. And then when you're there, the only thing you remember is the choir, because they be bad. They be banging.
Yeah.
You don't remember what the pastor said, but that choir was hot.
Right. You be crying up the hymn.
Like, you look at the pastor, what was the word? I guess that's why they sell the CDs leaving out the door. So, because you missed it, because you're going to miss it.
Right.
And you know, I used to go to, when I was in treatment, I was going to Empowerment Temple in Baltimore. That's Jamar Bryant. He's at the big church down in
Atlanta, right?
Yeah, Atlanta. He went down there. Yeah, I guess
not Pastor Bryant.
Yeah, he done went down there. He had to go down there and they got more people down there. Right? Mm-hmm. So he has a church. He had a church called Empowerment Temple. He started in Baltimore. I used to go to the church while I was in treatment because I was in treatment in Baltimore City. And I used to go where I used to get a $300 welfare check when I was in treatment for me and my daughter because I was pregnant in prison when I came out and I went to treatment. And I went down there and I remember I had my EBT card. Mm-hmm. And I ain't had no cash. But they had a machine for me to slide their EBT.
No.
They did. I lied. I did my $30. Yes, I did.
You lying.
No, and now when I go to churches to speak, you see them. They walking up and down, or they stand, and you just come and swipe your card. Cause see, they're not accepting you ain't got no cash, okay? You forgot your checkbook, but they know you got that credit card. You got that card up in their purse.
What?
Card, yeah.
Well, they see, got, I haven't been to church in a minute because I watch my church online. So
they got machines now. Yeah. Go directly to the church account. Yeah.
You no comment. I'm not going to even say nothing.
You know, I think COVID taught us that it's time to start, you know, worshiping in spirit and truth, as the Bible said that we were eventually, because Jesus said, it's going to come a time very soon where you will be worshiping in spirit and truth, not in a building. And not in the worship hall and all of that, you know, right. That's what we do. I tell people all the time, sometimes, you know, when we see the evangelical Christians act the way they act when Trump was in office, like, I am a follower of Jesus Christ. I ain't need no Christian no more. I just follow Jesus Christ because I do not want to be associated with that mess.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, and so I tell people, I did a lot of posts during that time, and I said, you know, people are going to come to realize this. And what I said was, everybody crying about they can't get to a building. They were mad that, right, that the government shut their church down. Mad. I mean, they were mad. And I'm like, it's y'all. If y'all can't deal with this, y'all better hope y'all did before the end times coming.
Yeah.
Because you can't get in a church, you would see nothing what's going to happen. And it's just like, they wouldn't be able to survive in the first generation church, you know? And you just watch that. And that's when I knew that the church was crumbling, that the building was going to crumble, because the people were depending too much on the building and not the relationship with God, you know? Because there's no, so what, you got to stay home. Good, you know? You can still, if they're talking, oh, you can't network. All this right. Technology. Are you kidding me?
Right.
Zoom. Everybody on Zoom for this and that, for everything else. Get on Zoom, talk to each other. I ain't had to talk to my church member. All I had to do was talk to Jesus during that time. I only wanted to talk to Jesus at that time.
Right. Has it become easier for you to share your story, or is it still triggering?
No, I mean, it depends. So, because one of my children decided not to come back to me yet, not to reunite with me. So sometimes when people ask me, after I'm finished presenting, people ask me about my children. And it's just like, if I'm very sensitive about my oldest daughter, I could get a little teary. But for the most part, I don't, you know. So I do a deliverance tour, which I'm out back on tour next week. I do a deliverance tour. It's a faith-based tour. And it's all around faith, and it's my story wrapped up in my faith and all of that, and deliverance, talking about the true power of God. And I get very emotional about that, only because of God, the spirit, right. You know, the spirit, so.
What were the reactions you received from some of the people that were in your book? Because you was very honest about your experience with them.
I wish they would. I wish they would have came at me and being mad. Now, I can't say one of my sisters was upset because, you know, my mother, what I said. But my mother was like, leave her alone. I know what that girl been through. You know what I mean? But like anybody else, like my ex-husband and all, I wish they would have came to me. Y'all got off easy.
Yeah.
You ain't getting off, because you know we're doing a Hollywood movie now. They ain't getting off easy in the movie.
Yeah, because when I was reading your book, I'm like, I can only imagine the stories that you didn't tell.
Right, because they told me the book was longer than that. They was like, my publisher was like, we got to stop it at some point. But I didn't care. I was telling my story because my story wasn't, I didn't tell my story to get back at anybody. I told my story because I wanted to talk, I want to tell people how dark it can get. And even then, God can still put a light in you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So my book was really, and I had to expose the truth. Mm-hmm. In order to accomplish the glory of God, the way it's accomplished in that book, I had to tell how dark it was. And the darkness came from the people, you know, and I really didn't care.
Right.
You know, now I did care about my mother, of course, you know.
Why did you care about your mother?
I take care of my mother financially. She's still Barbara.
The only reason why I asked is because when I was reading your book, one thing that resonated with me was when I was growing up, I was introduced to my mom as calling her by her first name. So uh-huh. when you was calling her by her first name, I'm like, it made me think like, when did I start calling her that? Because I never called her my mom.
Right.
So right. when were you yeah. introduced to that?
Oh, always. We called my grandmother Mill for Mildred. You know what I mean? So right. nobody, you know, we call that, you know, all of our aunts and uncles by their name. Nobody was like, had titles.
Right.
You know, and it wasn't just me. It was my cousins calling it, you know, it was the whole family.
Oh, wow. It
wasn't just me, my siblings and my mother, but my cousin called their mother Dad. You know, nobody called titles. Nobody, there was no mom and dad. It was only our generations that we changed that.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was your relationship like with your mom growing up?
Well, I mean, you know, it was tough. I was the oldest and she was abusive and neglectful. But, you know, what I realized and when I became a trauma expert and in my own treatment, especially writing that book.
Right.
Seeing the trauma she experienced just in the book.
Right.
About my mother, right in my book. My heart went out to her because she was a trauma survivor that didn't have the luxury of getting treatment like I did. Mm-hmm. You know, so. Yeah, I always loved my mother. Mm-hmm. I have never stopped loving my mother. And I think for me, when I started healing was I had to realize my mother is who she is and that my love for her should not expect her love for me.
Right.
And that I'm accountable for who I am. And I love her regardless. And that's why I take care of her now. So I had COVID. I came back from Atlanta last week. And Thursday, I woke up feeling bad and I tested myself and I tested positive. So she called me yesterday. She was like, what you doing? I said, I'm in bed with COVID. She said, with who?
She said, with who? With COVID?
Who you in bed with? Oh my God. I said, I'm not feeling well.
So, oh yeah. My God. Do you feel like she is responsible for introducing trauma into your life?
Oh, absolutely. But I absolutely. But yeah. I feel like she didn't know it. She didn't. I feel like she did what she knew to do. You know, the meetings and the, you know, and she only can do what she could do when you're an alcoholic. She was an alcoholic, right. You know what I mean? So, yeah. So, oh, yeah. I don't think she knew what she was doing. I just think she did what she knew to do. You right. know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Right. She did the best she could with what she had.
Yeah. What she thought she, you know what I mean? I don't know. Barbara has been through a lot, you know.
Yeah, I definitely got that from that when I was reading your book, even though you didn't share a lot into her story, but I can just only imagine things that she went through just from like. Well,
even the book, I talked about how I watched her screaming when my little brother was dead on the bed. You know what I mean? Could you imagine having a child die and not having support right. service? So when she was pregnant, 4 months pregnant with me, my older sister died. Mm. She was young, no support, right? And then my brother died that I talk about in the book. She had a total of 4 kids to die with no support. Yeah.
Oh, that's so right. Yeah.
I can really understand how that disconnect from her children is, you know?
Right.
You know, so.
And then I'm pretty sure during her time, who was talking about therapy?
Right. Oh, shoot. Right. Exactly. Right. You know? So, and she was an alcoholic at 15, you know?
Mm-hmm. Did she ever apologize to you and your siblings?
No. No.
Do you need it or do you want it?
I don't.
Yeah.
No, I don't. You know, I don't, because if she was to apologize, you know, right now, any apology Barbara gives is she really would not understand that. I don't think she would understand what she was even apologizing for.
Right.
But I don't need it. You know, and she's tough. You know, like right now because now she's getting sick and she's still hurt. She still want to drink. She still want to do her thing. She still want to do her drugs or whatever. And so, and she won't go to the doctor. So it's like, it's tough because she just recently had a stroke, right? Mm. And we can't, and it's tough. So it's like, it just disrupts everybody's lives. And just to go over there, try to take care of her or do whatever we got to do. We all got to get to the hospital or whatever. When all she got to do is let me take her to the doctors to get blood pressure pills.
Mm-hmm.
She won't.
Mm.
She won't go to the doctor. She's never had a physical ever in her life.
Oh, wow. Wow. So
we have to deal with the consequences of that.
Right.
You know, and it just, everybody's lives are just thrown, you know, when things like that happen.
Right.
So it's tough right now, you know, so it's still tough. It was tough growing up with her and now it's like, you know, but it is what it is, right?
Right. Did your siblings ever thank you for protecting them?
Oh, my sisters and brothers, you know, no, they didn't have to, you know. I think there's always that unspoken, we were there for each other, you know right. What I mean? And stuff like that, you know. And so right now, I do a lot for my siblings and stuff like that. You know, we do a lot with each other, for each other. And, you know, it's just this common knowledge of we had, you know what I mean? Right. And so, yeah.
I mean, the only reason why I asked, because I just feel like when I was reading your book, like being that you are the oldest, you felt like it was your responsibility to make sure that they ate or make sure nobody didn't was sexually taking advantage of them. So I know, I feel like you're not the type of person who need that type of like, you don't need that type of, what's the word I'm looking right. for? Not
validation or
things. Validation, right.
I don't need that. And for the most part, they didn't even know they were being protected because right. that's how well they were being protected.
Right. I was watching your documentary and I also saw your mom. I'm like, oh, your mom, she still look lit.
So listen, if I call her right now, she probably lit. What do you mean?
Yeah.
If I call her right now, she probably lit.
I said, okay, Miss Barbara.
You see the documentary?
Yeah, I was watching.
So, yeah. If I call her right now, she probably lit. Yeah.
I said, she's still out here.
She's still out in them streets.
So I was watching a documentary and I saw a photo of you and your ex-husband and it was pretty evident that he was dating a child.
Yeah.
Why do you think people turn their eyes to older men dating underage girls, especially back in the day?
You know, it's really weird because when he was involved in the church, choir, you know, so he was had a good job. He worked for his father who was owned their own company. He lived in a big old house, you know, so he was like the most eligible bachelor at church, right?
Right.
Like all, right? And he was after me. And you know, it's funny because nobody, and I know that people knew, like he would take me to the clubs and all that. I knew that people knew. I wasn't old enough to be in a club, but even in the church, you know, but we started, I was still in high school, right? And I placed myself in the environment of older people because I wanted to drink.
Right.
So if they want to use the excuse, they say, well, we didn't know. She always was with older people. So we thought she was, you know. But like you said, that picture was very evident, right?
Very evident.
Looked more like his daughter, right?
Right.
And
that was a grown man.
Yeah. And so, and me holding that was our son. And so I just think that people they care more about him than they cared about me. You know, right. It was like, he was Keith Kane, you know, right. He had it going on. And, you know, and then he was an honorary member at the club. And you know, it's ridiculous. Like now, of course. Anything like that happens, you know, we got all these movements to protect children. Back then, no.
And your mom also approved the marriage.
Like, he signed the marriage license.
Yeah,
they became drinking buddies. So.
Yeah. So when did things take a turn for the worse within your relationship?
Well, early on, really, before we got married, because I remember the first time he actually hit me. I was pregnant with my son. And I remember he's on the phone with a woman and I was asking, why are you talking to her? You know? And he just started punching me in my side while I was pregnant, while he was on the phone. And so I was 17 then and I was pregnant with my son. And so it started before we got married. But again, domestic violence to me was just what it was.
Right.
You know, men hit you, but they love you. That's, you know, that was my mindset because that's what I seen. I seen my mother get beat by men then lay in the bed with them.
Right. Okay?
That's love, expression of love. You know, so I've never left a man for beating me back then, you know, and because I thought it go along with the relationship, you know.
Right.
You know, and I think that he left me. I don't think I would have ever left him, and you know, back then it was him leaving me, because again, no matter how many times he stomped me and beat me over and over again, it's just what it was, right? When you've been abused by men all your life, right? And now you got this man that you thought would protect you from all the other bad men, but he still beat you. You come to think maybe something's wrong with me,
right?
You know, so, and that's the way it was. My sexual abuse started at age 9.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how a grown man that whole body so big it covered my own child's body would find any pleasure out of hurting me.
Right.
Then you got all these other sexual abuse. And then you got all these physical abuse. And then, you know, your father left when you was a baby. So shoot. You know, then you got this older man that beat you. I'm like, okay, it's me. It can't be everybody, right? That's what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes just a part of who you are.
Mm. And I know after he left, you began dating another man named Mike. Did you think he was different? Because I thought he was different at first.
I thought I was different too, girlfriend. Right.
I was like, damn.
Like, right? Like, seriously, dude? You know, and so when I met Mike, he was like, wow. I was like, okay. He had a good job, you know what I mean? He was reserved in the army or whatever he did every other weekend. And I'm like, you know, and it went well until I started really getting out there on the drugs. And that was his way of dealing with me on the drugs.
Right.
You know. Yeah, I know, right? You were like,
right. Right.
Yeah.
And you became pregnant by Mike and he insisted that you receive an abortion because you were still a married woman. Did that experience change your views on abortion?
Yeah.
I figured it did.
Yeah. So, you know, and it was the condo abortion. It was, as you can read. They didn't tell me I was 20 weeks pregnant. They didn't tell me that I was going to have to push my baby out. They was going to push me in labor. They was going to kill the baby and push me and give me something to contract me to push the baby out. It wasn't that 3 weeks fetus, you know, it was a baby.
Right.
20 weeks babies survive these days with you know, technology and medical and all of that now. But it was the most horrific experience. And I thank God that it was that bad. Because they lined us up in these gurneys, right?
Mm-hmm.
All these Black women. They gave us an IV and they put something in our IV. And then they put bamboo sticks inserted in our vagina to make us contract. Mm-hmm. And they put us in labor. So women were screaming. I was like, and so I'm telling the nurse, I'm hurting. And she said, oh, it's time for you push.
Mm.
Push what? You know, oh my God, that was horrific.
Yeah, that was a lot to read. And yeah. I had an abortion and I was like, oh my God, I couldn't imagine.
Yeah, so that and the time you read how the detention center gave me the wrong medication. And so it's like, and I was 5 months then when that happened. That was like insane. So that abortion was so horrific. One of the girls' baby was born alive and lived an hour.
When it came to the situation in the detention center, could you have done something? Because they pretty, I don't know, the way I interpreted, they pretty much killed the baby, no?
Well, so what happened was, so I get to the detention center, and by then, they used to see me, right?
Right.
So I get there, and they, you know, and I say, hey, look, I'm pregnant. I know when I'm pregnant. You know what I mean? I know when I'm pregnant.
Right.
And they say whatever came. So they had the two ladies that was inside me. When a medical nurse came down, when an intake nurse came down, she took a urine sample, all of us. Don't know why, but she did. And I guess they got it mixed up and told me I had a urinary tract infection, but I wasn't pregnant. I said, I know I'm pregnant. They said, we know what we're doing. So if you don't take medication when they come around, if you refuse it, they put you in what they call isolation until you stabilize. We called it a hole, 91 corner hole, right? So I said, okay, well, maybe I'm not. Maybe, I don't know. So I took the medication. So all they had to do was to retest me, give me a blood test, but they wouldn't listen to me. And they medicated me as if I had a urinary tract infection, right?
Mm.
So when I went to use the bathroom, my baby head came out. I'm like, you know, and now they don't know what to do. Then they shackled me to the gurney and allowed me to lay there with my baby, deceased baby stuck between my legs while they try to figure out who's going to take me to the emergency room. And then that right there was.
Yeah, I can't even imagine.
That right there, and then I go to the emergency room, they yank and pull, they finally get the baby, right? And then because they don't have the staff to stay at the hospital with me, they sent me back to the detention center. The detention center said, we don't have staff to stay with her, she needs to come back here. And they put me right back in my cell. The next day, I passed out from hemorrhaging.
Mm.
A lot of the tissue was still left in my body, and I had to be rushed back to the hospital to have emergency DNC operation. So all this is going on, all, you know, and then I go into a very deep depression.
I mean, how could you not?
Right.
Do you feel like addiction is taken seriously within our community? And the reason why I ask is because a lot of people feel like drugs are a choice when it's really a disease.
I think people now with Unfortunately, it's really taken seriously now because of fentanyl.
Yeah, man. Woo.
You know, I'm like, Black people been ODing forever. You know, from heroin, you know what I mean?
They, right.
All of a sudden, y'all got something to hit people down and bring them back. I remember hanging out with people in the cars and you look over and they gone.
Right.
You know, they were shooting up heroin, you know, but now it's hitting the upper middle class. And so now they all of a sudden.
Funny. Y'all got to see her face.
No, for real, but all of a sudden they got whatever, they, you hit somebody, they telling everybody carrying it now, just in case. Just in case you see somebody at the bus stop, here you go, take a whole bunch up.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that our public health system is so messed up, and it takes a certain group of people to it start to impact before it become a crisis in our country. That said, crack cocaine should have been a crisis.
Oh yeah.
I still got, I'm doing a television show called Restoration, and it's about three women that still has not recovered from crack cocaine from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s and
60s. I was doing research because I was, I go down a rabbit hole and just do a lot of research. And I feel like a lot of times people don't talk about how crack cocaine affected women.
Right. Exactly. And yeah. That in itself was an epidemic, and it was never taken to that level mm-hmm. of concern. But now,
right, because people been ODing forever, so why all of a sudden we got the urgency?
Now all of a sudden y'all was able to create this drug that bring people back to life instantly.
Man,
get hit with that. People are dying and get hit. It's the touch of Jesus.
Yeah,
I'm telling you, because they come right back, and I mean like right back, like ping.
Yeah,
you know, I'm like, people been dying from overdose for years.
Babies been dying,
right? And now all of a sudden y'all were able to put resources in it, make it available to create a drug to, when this happens, people can, their hearts can start again.
Crazy. Crazy.
But now, we still have not cured breast cancer. That's what gets me.
Right. Or we still haven't found a cure for
lupus, breast cancer,
Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's. But when the man penis got soft, the next day there was a blue pill. The first day they had a blue pill.
Listen, they're gonna make sure that works.
Right.
Now, this concludes part one of this week's episode. Please stay tuned for part two, dropping next Tuesday. Until next time, everyone, later.
AT&T connects an ode to podcast. Connect the alarm, change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze, 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower, lather up with the news, sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.